they would do things to, you know, prime the patient. They would have to sit in a room full of, you know, jars with diseased organs or tapeworms in them, and they'd wait for a while surrounded by all these things. And then when they went in to see the doctor, they were very suggestible. The doctor would find that, oh, they had a tapeworm. One particular quack medicine doctor actually had this sort of capsule thing where it had a rolled up, not paper, but something a bit more heavy duty, and he would give it to them as the treatment, and the paper would unfurl and they would eject it from their lower parts when they went to the toilet, which meant that they felt completely gratified and as though they'd had their money's worth.
Imagine it's 1850. You're living in a small town away from the latest innovations in medicine. And you get sick, really sick. What are you going to do? Who are you going to turn to? That feeling of desperation is the reason why we had the snake oil salesman, traveling hucksters who sold ointments, tinctures, medicines, and the eponymous snake oil. On this episode of Scammapalooza, I talk to historian Dr. Jo Klein about her research into the ethically dubious world of quack medicine. If you enjoy the podcast, why not support me on Patreon? This is a one-man operation, and any support you can give makes a massive difference. There's a link in the show notes. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson, and this is Scammapalooza. Doctor, I didn't know. So you're a doctor. You have a PhD. I did not know that. Can I call you Dr. Jo Klein?
Once and then drop it because it sounds so pretentious. Remembering, right, of course, that like I'm not going to, you know, be able to. Actually, I did a first aid course last week, so I could resuscitate. But prior to that, you know, like when you're on a plane and you just have a chat to the nice elderly couple next to you, and then the, you know, the flight attendant goes, "Is there a doctor?" And they both look at you and you're like, I hadn't got to the bit of explaining that I'm not that kind of doctor.
Well, okay, but I feel like, yes, no, you should not be practicing medicine. However, you are a historian, and one of the areas of history in which you are interested in is
medical history.
Medical history. So if someone came to you with a time machine, you could just travel back in time and, like, you could treat someone in the past, or maybe you could just point out.
By what I'm talking about today, I would be so qualified to teach.
What draws you to Australian? Because we're going to talk about Australian.
Have we started yet?
Yeah, absolutely. We've started now. I'll use some of that. I'll remove the bit. I'll remove anything super embarrassing. But I'll. Oh, cool. Yeah, totally. I'll remove the bit where you said we started yet.
Yeah. Now leave that in. That's the best bit.
Yeah, totally. What I mean, obviously, you look at various areas of history, but why are you interested in? What are we going to call it? Quack, Australian quack history, colonial quack history?
Not even Australian colonial. I mean, my sort of look of it is much more international. And I can tell you exactly when I got interested in quack medicine. A friend of mine was doing a presentation and he brought out this sort of family heirloom, which was an electric shock machine from about 1900. And it was the most wonderful thing I'd ever seen. It's like it has a generator. You turn the handle and you hold on to the electrodes and it electric shocks you. And he showed me this thing and my mouth fell open and I just went, I'm going to need one of those. So the most beautiful part of it is the lovely advertising inside lid, which is what it was used for. It's mostly women suffering, you know, women's issues. But I sort of decided I'm going to hunt down one of those. And it is honestly one of the favorite things I own. But also it's been massively useful. It's been like an investment. My first magic show was about pseudopsychology and it was part of it. I turned it into a magic trick and it has featured in more magic shows than, you know, pretty much anything else I've ever bought or learned. So it's still my absolute prized possession. It's actually been borrowed and used in exhibitions and, you know, I just love it. And I suppose the thing that really excited me was the audacity of the images and the language and the general outrage that as a modern day person you feel when you see anything to do with quack medicine. What's really great about it is, you know, it works. It still works. And I'll take it to a show and I'll say, look, you know, I'm not going to really electrocute anyone unless you really want to be. And, of course, everyone lines up after the show.
To be electrocuted, to be treated. So yeah. what did it, I mean, when you say it works, what you mean is it produces electricity.
Yeah.
It doesn't, it works. Right. It doesn't work though as a medical.
You know what? No, look, I'm not sure. A few people said they thought it really helped, but then again, that is, you know, that's quack medicine.
Mm.
It might distract your brain slightly because you're giving a rude shock. So perhaps it does kind of work. I mean, of course, electroshock therapy is used in a contemporary context for psychiatric, psychological issues. So there's obviously some merit to it. But I suppose if I'm going to talk about quack medicine, I know that you're a language person. You like hearing about the origins of.
I do.
You do.
Very much so.
I was aware of that. And
Before we get onto that, the device, I still don't know what it's actually supposed, like what you mentioned, the advertising, what was it supposed to do? What were they claiming it did?
Basically, it was to cure faintness and hysteria, mostly in women. So there's a beautiful picture of a woman kind of reclining over a chair. There's like quite a lot of gendered language through different, you know, quack medicines. And I'll give you an example. There was this great medicine called Dr. Williams Pink Pills for Pale People. And it's supposed to cure, so it says it's a blood builder and a nerve tonic. So, of course, in the past, and it's all the way through literature, if you look a bit pale, that's sort of shorthand for letting people know that you're ill. And if you're living in the Victorian era, you're probably going to die. So it might foreshadow a death in literature. But this particular nerve tonic cures anemia, all nervous diseases, locomotor ataxia, paralysis, rheumatism, headaches, all female weaknesses, suppressions of the periods, pale and sallow complexions, all diseases arising from mental worry, overwork, excess, and early decay. So that's really comforting. So that's one of the general ads you saw a lot, but there was this other beautiful one I found, which was the same product but targeted at women in business. So there's a nice little, you know, etching of a woman, you know, Victorian garb, the high-necked blouse, long sleeve, sitting at a desk doing some sort of bookkeeping work. And the ad copy runs as follows. Businessmen often express the opinion that there is one thing which will prevent women from completely filling men's place in the business world. They can't be depended on because they are sick too often. It is true that many women are compelled to look forward to times when they are unable to attend to social or business duties. Their appearance plainly indicates their condition, and they are reluctant to be seen even by their friends. Read what a businesswoman says to such sufferers. And Mrs. C.W. Mansfield from 58 Farrer Street, Detroit, Michigan says, "A complication of female ailments kept me awake at night and wore me out. I could get no relief from medicine and hope was slipping away from me. A young woman in my employ gave me a box of Dr. Williams Pink Pills for Pale People. I took them and was able to rest at night for the first time in months. I bought more and they cured me as they also cured several other people in my knowledge. As a young businesswoman, I am pleased to recommend them as they did more for me than any physician, and I can give Dr. Williams Pink Pills for Pale People credit for my general good health today." So this is kind of an interesting moment in history where women, you know, are trying to enter the workforce. And, you know, this is a number one concern. They have to be perceived to be strong and, you know, healthy. And this targeted advertising, I suppose, you know, was going straight to that point.
So because they're not hamstrung by the truth, they're not having to be true. And because it is marketing, feels like it's a great, these kind of ads are a great reflection of the worries of people at that time.
It's absolutely true, yes.
So in this case, it's not, I mean, obviously it's a list of ailments that people are worried about, but also things worried about how, you know, like you said, that people are worried about being seen as pale.
Well, I suppose it was an economic issue because the reality was that people couldn't often afford doctor's fees. And generally, quack medicine practitioners or quack medicine shows, which is something I also adore, often happen in regional or remote country towns. So in the UK, in America, and to an extent Australia as well. So the first thing was that they would see it as a good investment if there was one medicine that did everything. And something that keeps being dug up in archaeological digs, you know, from about the 1800s, or 1880s generally, is, well, maybe a bit early as well, my 1850s to the 1880s, was an ointment called Holloway's Ointment. I'm not sure if that's ringing a bell, but it keeps popping up because it was so popular just in ordinary, everyday and lower class households where you had one thing that fixed everything. And it was an ointment that was for ulcers, gout, rheumatism, sore breasts, sore legs, chapped hands, chilblains, boils, insect bites. And you can hear that those are things that people who are workers would have suffered a lot. So farmers, miners would have been quite likely to have these symptoms. Somebody who is upper class and stays indoors mostly is, you know, unlikely to have chapped hands and insect bites. So the idea that you could have this one remedy that fixed everything was very, very appealing. And, of course, there's kind of a lack of critical thinking around a lot of these medicines because many people didn't go to school, but also critical thinking wasn't terribly taught back then either. So, yeah.
So with the case of something like Holloway's, because that's an international product, I think it was an English product, but then sold internationally. And it gained, I guess, a reputation in the sense of, well, this is big in England and this is big, you know, around the world. So it becomes a trusted brand and people start buying it. Do people, because it's so vague, you know, the advertising is so, you know, it'll list off a whole lot of specific things, but will also list off, you know, kind of fairly random symptoms. Do you find that there's, I guess, a kind of people use it for different things in different purposes? You know, like in this town, everyone says, oh, I use Holloway's for X, Y, and Z, and then you will go somewhere else and it'll be, oh, no, we use it for ABC, and it sort of becomes something that will solve local problems.
I think that, look, I'd say that's probably very likely. I can only speculate because I haven't actually read anything to that effect. However, it's sort of considered a cure-all, so I suppose it would be. But the interesting thing is we talked a little bit about titles. So you just found out I have a PhD, so I am a doctor. But that was something that was used a lot in quack medicine. So every person who invented something was either a professor or a doctor. Now I'm using sarcastic inverted commas because I'm going to use that a lot in this talk because everyone gave themselves some sort of title. Because, of course, even back then, expert opinion or expert knowledge was valued. And a lot of them went even further than just using the title, a title like professor or doctor. They used medical symbology as well. So, for example, the Holloway's little ceramic jar, something you would say would be a snake, which we associate with a symbol of healing. It's something we still see today. And also things like going back to ancient symbology as well. So this one had Hygieia, who was a goddess of health, on the jar. So they really invested in this symbology to give weight and authority to these claims.
The symbology is really fascinating because I think it serves to as you mentioned, the kind of lack of critical thinking that is, I'm not sure if they didn't do it so much as were bad at it, you know, like compared perhaps by today's standards, which is perhaps why our advertising needs to be more sophisticated to get around that. Yeah. But that symbology seems like a really clever way of circumventing those logical, reasonable faculties, that idea of we're going to present something to you and it's going to have a brand that you associate with health. We're going to use words like doctor and professor that you'll associate with health. We're going to use
education.
Education, all of these symbols of truth and health and reliability, rather than actually trying to make claims which are, you know, like in terms of the actual evidence, but trying to actually provide evidence that people will then actually have to think about. It's sort of a way of getting people to kind of make decisions without the need for that kind of critical thought.
Well, it's actually visual shorthand. So, you know, just a few things like, you know, doctor or a certain logo or symbol suggests credibility. So even if you don't know why, your brain is saying, yes, that's reputable.
Mm.
What's also interesting is if we look at the actual product. Now, one of my favorite accounts of this of medical shows is called Four White Horses and a Brass Band by a woman called Violet McNeil, which is interesting because there were not many medical women, medical sideshow women. But she talks a lot about, like, it's a very first-hand account of her experiences. And she talks about some of the stories. So it's not just about advertising, but in the medical show, you have to create a narrative around the medicine. And one of them she talks about was in a medicine show, often you have a lovely performance, which is really entertaining, particularly to small town people who maybe don't get to see many shows or can't afford. So it's a street performance, it's free. And between acts, you'd have the medical pitch. And she talks about a character called Arizona Bill, the great benefactor of mankind, who was attired in buckskins. And he tells a long story about being stolen by Indians when he was an infant and being adopted by the chief of a tribe where he had access to the most intimate tribal secrets, which he studied at length. He managed to free himself and was now able to share his discoveries with friends of his own race at the modest price of $1 a bottle. He'd been able to salvage the formula for a liniment of peculiar and powerful properties known as rattlesnake oil. The Indians rubbed themselves with this to prevent rheumatism, he explained. Arizona Bill was actually a Welshman and spoke with a Cockney accent, but that didn't make any difference to the yokels. They still bought. All the other actors hustled through the audience, selling the herbs and oil and shouting, "Sold out again, doctor," whenever their immediate supply was exhausted. When the last loose dollar had been extracted from snap purses, Arizona Bill bowed off the stage and the curtain lifted it once more on the short afterpiece. So there's a couple of techniques there. Obviously, using stories about ancient or unknown tribal secrets, which someone has been able to access for some particular reason, some sort of costume to make yourself look exotic. And the technique, something that probably magicians use a little bit too in different ways, which is if you go, "Sold out, sold out, sold out," people go, "Oh, my gosh, I'm going to run out. So, you know, I better buy now." It's a really compels you to buy. So if we say, you know, in an ad for magic, you know, show there's tickets are selling fast, even if we've only sold two tickets, it creates an incentive for people to go, "Oh, I actually was going to see that show. I better buy some tickets. I don't want to miss out." But it was the same idea, this constant loud proclamation of "sold out," when really it just meant someone had three bottles and they've sold the three bottles and they'd go back to the stage to get more. So, and this kind of narrative pretty much was fitted out for almost everything, especially a lot of Orientalism, so a lot of Asian stories. Violet McNeil was, I think, born in Iowa, and she was actually called Princess Lotus Blossom.
Well, doesn't that go to the, I mean, the, you know, in the American phrase for a lot of this is the snake oil salesman, and snake oil itself was said to be a Chinese,
yes, you know,
was they were taking a Chinese a traditional medicine, and then
Chinese water snakes, which weren't in America.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Which means that they just kind of like went, "Oh, well, any snakes will do." And of course, they didn't actually use any snake oil. They used completely different things. But the thing is, it had to be cheap. It had to be easily accessible on the road. And it had to give the impression of medicine. So that was really important. And I'll read you just another little passage, which is how she actually makes the medicine. So this was a medicine that Violet McNeil and her husband sold. So as I said, the really important things were that, you know, it was cheap and available and could be made on the road. So they had a product called Vital Sparks, which was to assured masculine virility. "We bought a barrel of hard, small black candy known as buckshot candy. We poured a quantity of it into an empty drawer, sprinkled it with water, shook the drawer back and forth until all the candy was damp. Then we threw in a handful of powdered aloe vera and shook it again until the pellets were covered with a thin coating of the bitter stuff. It only took a few minutes longer to transfer them to small pasteboard boxes. So literally, she was in a hotel. She got the little bedside table drawer, filled it with sweets and a little bit of water, and then added some powdered aloe vera and shook it around. Easy, cheap, unhygienic. But really, and of course, it would have been the pitch. So it's really just the story and the performance and also how the boxes were created, you know, with what kind of appetizing or the name of the product, Vital Sparks, that really sold the product.
And that idea of performance, you know, and I mean, I think it's Voltaire had that line, I'm paraphrasing, but that's the job, you know, the job of the doctor is to amuse the patient until nature takes its course. And it's the way in which this medicine is presented and that line between entertainment and medicine and quack medicine is it feels like it isn't just them using quack medicine, using entertainment to sell quack medicine, but rather the two are intricately linked in a way in which you can't tell where one ends and the other begins. The entertainment is part of the cure itself.
Yeah.
And and the buying of the product is like with a lot of marketing, you're very rarely buying the product, you're buying how the product makes you feel. And it must make people feel good to buy this stuff after experiencing the show.
Well, I think the thing is that there were so many different psychological techniques used. So one thing they talked about was they had pop-up clinics in a town. So it might be, you know, traveling doctor, this or that, the medicine show, you know, here for 5 days only, and they'd get like an empty room in the town, like a hotel room or just an empty shopfront, get a license, and they'd set it up as a clinic so you could come in and be examined. And they would do things to, you know, prime the patient. They'd have to sit in a room full of, you know, jars with diseased organs or tapeworms in them, and they'd wait for a while surrounded by all these things. And then when they went in to see the doctor, they were very suggestible. So the doctor would find that, oh, they had a tapeworm. And one particular quack medicine doctor actually had this sort of capsule thing where it had like a rolled up bit of something like a, not paper, but something a bit more heavy duty. And you'd give it to them as the treatment, and the paper would unfurl and they would eject it from their lower parts when they went to the toilet, which meant that they were, you know, they felt completely gratified and as though they'd had their money's worth. I went into the doctor, I had clearly had a tapeworm. He gave me a pill that I paid for and I can see the evidence. So it's really foolproof, and you can see just how the techniques work with magic as well. It's just... magicians, we use really similar techniques.
It's that idea of, and I mean, like in magic, there's that idea of the magic moment. You can't just have something impossible happen. It's important to have that moment of like, this is when it happened. This is, you know, when I waved the wand or tapped the card three times, or, you know, said the magic words or whatever it is. There's got to be something that really makes it feel like it's happening, and it sounds like this medicine is sort of doing the same thing.
Well, amazing, because the thing is, the more powerful magic is one that happens when the magician is far, far away. Like something can happen afterwards. So the magician, you know, slash the quack doctor isn't even there anymore, and then, you know, they're completely gratified by this transaction because they can see that clearly they had a tapeworm.
Yeah.
So I like how well thought out these things are. I like the fact that they studied each other. So they were constantly, they had groups and colleagues, and they would, you know, see different techniques working, and then they'd apply it, and it would sort of, you know, something like a collective technique or collective strategy for doing something.
And you even see, I mean, the way in which you're describing these, we're kind of hopping from country to country a little bit, and yet the style is still the same. You know, Clark Stanley or those types of people in America are doing very similar things to what people are doing in Australia. And you have, as you mentioned, you have people from Wales coming. You know, like it's this international thing in which there's a lot of similarities between them, even though
Yeah, because the thing is, we were the colonies, so things were being imported. I mean, certainly in the early days of European settlement, it took a while before things were being produced in Australia. So they would arrive with new immigrants, or they would be sent as a shipment. And a lot of these products, even though they were American and British, they were sold in pharmacies here. And also you see the same techniques being applied in other ways. So one of my favourite Australian sort of, I think, not quack medicine, but along the lines of, is during the turn of the century, so 1900, 1901, there was a small outbreak of the bubonic plague in Australia. Not everyone knows that. People are surprised by that, because when they think about the bubonic plague, they think of medieval Europe. They might think that perhaps in some countries like India, until recently, there were some outbreaks, but they don't really think about Australia. So it was kind of like COVID, in that everyone sort of took advantage sometimes of the situation. And there was a bicycle company who decided to use this outbreak as a way to sell more products.
Mm.
And this is the line of thinking. They said, okay, if you are a business person and you work in the city, you're going to have to catch public transport in, and you're going to be close to other people. You don't want that. You should ride your bicycle into the city. We sell bicycles. Buy a bicycle and avoid getting bubonic plague.
That scans. I mean, you're going to get less
it
maybe?
It is, but I just thought it was just so hilarious. That was their advertising slogan.
Yeah, that is true, to hang your entire thing on that.
That is fine.
Yeah. It reminded me a little bit of Commedia dell'arte, you know, the sort of the Italian comedy theatre style, and they would have these shows and they would have the plot would be the same every time, but every time a troupe would come to a new town, they would learn about whatever people cared about in that town and then add lots of jokes about the local mayor or the, you know, whatever the gossip of the town is, to make the show funnier. And I get the feeling you get sort of a similar thing happening with this type of marketing, is that it can be very localized, and it can be, okay, you're worried about the plague, buy a bicycle, you know, because that's the thing that we're worried about today in this particular location.
Well, the strategies haven't changed that much. I mean, comedians would do that as well. I mean, they come to a city on their tour, and they'll find out a few things that will either really annoy or really make audience happy, and they'll use that information. I think it was that Daniel Kitson, he came in and just basically mocked us. He said, "I've heard you Melburnians are like the New York of America." And he's like,
that's "Yeah, true. That's true." I think that's it's that, and there's a flexibility I think that entertainers have that perhaps someone who is more beholden to the truth and more beholden to reason and logic, that they will have, right? That they have to be able to be flexible like that. Yeah. Tell me some more of your favourites. Particularly, do you have any more Australian favourites that you would like to share?
Well, look, I have to say the quack medicine industry wasn't as huge in Australia. And as I said, a lot of it was imported. One thing I would desperately like to get my hands on is a Dr. Scott's electric hairbrush.
Yes, I've seen the ad for that. So what exactly did the electric hairbrush do?
Well, first of all, it has the word electric in it. And all good quacks from a certain period of time had the word magnetic or electric in it. Of course, they didn't have either things in them. But it was, you know, the new buzzword. And so this one was for curing baldness. The idea was that you could brush your hair and you could cure baldness, which there really isn't a cure for. But there were so many quack medicines, which promised that. And there was a story about a bald quack medical salesman who was bald, and he was selling, you know, bald tonic. And someone said, "Hey, you're bald. Why haven't you used a tonic on yourself?" And he's like, "Oh, if only I'd started using it before I lost all my hair." You know, you have to start it before all your hair. So I'd love to get one of those for my collection, because it's just like, it's got a beautiful back of it. It's got like, looks like a, almost like a royal seal. And it's also got this arm holding some thunderbolts because, of course, that's what electricity is. But the other one that I absolutely love that I do have is a bottle of the Seven Sutherland Sisters Grower, which is in New York, devised by their father, the Reverend Fletcher Sutherland. And the whole thing about these young women, all sisters, was they had massively long hair. And they sort of developed their own show. They were good at singing and dancing and they played instruments. And he basically toured them to perform and sold their hair tonic alongside. So they became the act. And also no one could really rip them off that much because, I mean, I suppose you could have found seven women who all had really long hair. But, you know, he'd kind of made it quite unique. And his backstory was that his wife who had died and left them all, you know, left him with these girls, had used this special, you know, family tonic on the girl's hair, and that's why the hair was so wonderful.
That I like that specificity, that idea of making it, as you said, an act that no one can steal, making a product that can't be generic. Do you think there is a reason why some of these products sort of stood the test of time and others didn't? Because we don't, I mean, obviously cures for baldness are still around, electric hairbrushes.
Well, I'm sure there actually probably are. I'm sure there's something that someone would sell where you run it over your head and it. I feel like I've even seen something like that advertised.
There's a great book I've got called Kill or Cure, which is just a selection of ads from the, snake oil quack medicines from the period. And flipping through it, you'll turn one page and it'll say something utterly ridiculous about, you know, eat this tapeworm and lose weight. And you go, wow, I can't believe people, you know, that they could advertise that in magazines and what a ridiculous product. And then on the next page, it says, try this homeopathic medicine. And you say, oh, that one's still around. That one's still around and people are still using it.
Well, that's, I suppose, by learning about this era of history, we kind of can really see, we can be more critical in our approach to medicine because you have to look for active ingredients and you have to, but look, there are, you know, laws now in terms of what you can sell. It doesn't mean that there aren't a lot of practitioners of quack product.
But what makes something like homeopathy, which is literally nothing, you know, you're literally buying water or sugar, why would something like that stand the test of time, but we're not all buying devices that electrocute itself? You know, one is a multi-billion dollar industry and the other is sort of seen as a bit of a historical footnote.
I think to me, like, it feels like homeopathy has its origin in kind of like medieval or ancient societies, and I suppose maybe it appeals in terms of, you know, we've got this hectic modern world where this is something that's kind of very natural. It's the opposite. And also people know that water really can't hurt. It's very much about natural products. So maybe it's that all of those things are reassuring. And also so I think some homeopathic products, from my knowledge, I've got a little bit of alcohol in them too, which if you take a few drops, it's going to make you feel a little bit better potentially. And, of course, a lot of the old quack medicines, they had all sorts of things in them, like cocaine. Of course, if you take this thing, you're going to feel better. And some of them were just alcohol, like, you know, literally medicinal alcohol. So they were almost advertised as a medicine, but it was just a type of drink, just an alcoholic drink. So there actually was nothing else in it. It feels like, you know, something that someone would have made in a medieval hut using, you know, elm bark, which they'd boiled. And so I think it kind of feels like perhaps people reconnecting to their ancient, simpler roots. I mean, this is just my theory. I have no evidence to support this. This is my interpretation of why people perhaps turn to it.
Do you think that very traditional idea – That specific idea of the show, of the snake, the kind of the snake oil salesman show and the professor and the doctor, we don't do that in that exact way today. Was it something that evolved and changed until it became medical marketing that we see today? Or was there sort of a particular point in history where it stopped, where it kind of died out and was replaced with new ideas?
Well, I think that the format itself, the traveling medicine show, was like a lot of other things, like performance in museums and, you know, vaudeville, was that cinema killed it. So I think the advent of cinema stopped people, you know, being interested as much in live performance for a while. And certainly, you know, venues, perhaps, you know, more theatrical venues were turned into cinema. So I'd say that's perhaps one theory. The other thing is that it was a group, an industry of people, and if they thought that it wasn't going to continue, like it had a golden age, if it wasn't going to continue being profitable, you know, people didn't really enter into it as much. I'm thinking probably like it was very popular for women particularly to go into the convent in the 60s, which means you see a lot of very elderly nuns, but you don't see many younger nuns. So I feel like perhaps less people took up medical showmanship as a career. Plus also people may have just become a little bit more litigious. So when, you know, acts about safe food and medicine and, you know, having to, you know, justify or be credentialed in some way came in. I mean, that would have been pretty much the death of a lot of it. But maybe just as a type of entertainment, it died. People's tastes got more sophisticated.
As Australia grew, there is more regulation and different trends and different ideas come in and replace the old ones.
Sometimes as simple as fashion, you know, it's just not considered, it might be considered a little passé after a while. You know, there's a more sophisticated form of entertainment and, you know, oh, and the yokels go and see that. So everyone wants to, you know, better themselves. They wouldn't engage as much.
So today, if we want to see a snake oil salesman, you can go and see someone who recreates them, and you are someone who recreates them yourself.
I am. Actually, we're thinking we might do that show mid-year for the Melbourne Magic Festival again. Yeah, so I do it with Dr. David Waldron, and we do enjoy the fact that we are both doctors, and we've discussed this point that, you know, anyone, it's a type of, you know, authority, and we make fun of the title because, of course, as I mentioned, everyone was a professor or a doctor in this particular world. So we do kind of shows which imitate the Victorian style lecture in a way, because it has, we explain things, we have, you know, images and primary sources and real artifacts. So we actually sort of bring in our collection. We both have this historical passions separately. So Dave and I often work together on historical projects because we have the same interests. So we've like both got our own collection that we can combine. And our show was called The Quack and the Charlatan. He's the quack, I'm the charlatan. We found that more women were likely to be charlatans.
Hang on, what's the difference between a quack and a charlatan?
That's a really great question. We actually discussed it in the show, but spoiler, no, I'm desperately trying to remember. Often the quack is specific. As I said, there weren't many women doing medical shows. Charlatans, I mean, you certainly had women who were doing deceptive sort of practices. Yeah. Often they were brought on to do things like mind reading, like as an entertainment in the medicine shows. Or they were, you know, had mystic powers as an entertainment thing. So often they were involved in a sort of deceptive type performance style. But we just liked the idea of a quack and a charlatan. So we talk about the history because we're both historians and we're both performers, and it's actually a magic show as well. So I've translated a lot of the strategies into magic tricks to kind of replicate some of the ways that people were tricked. So we performed it at the 2022 Ballarat Heritage Festival. And like a lot of our other shows, we bring them out when we feel we have the right venue in the theatre, and also, you know, we keep redesigning them and changing them and adding bits of historical knowledge. So we do love those things. So it's like a combination. It's like a lecture and a magic show at the same time.
And I assume we can buy dodgy health products, cocaine, tiny pills with fake worms inside them, all of those types of things after the show.
We discussed merch.
Oh, you've got to have merch, even if it's
we
just...
We discussed merch. We haven't got to merch yet. But I feel like you're right. Do you know what? That's kind of brilliant and we should definitely do merch.
All right. I feel like I've lost all respect for you as a professional, as an expert on quackery and the fact you're not selling fake medicine at the end of your show.
I know. I think it's just, suggestion. We can improve this show with merch.
Awesome. Thank you very much for the chat.
You're most welcome.